Thank you, Commissioners. Let me explain that Jim Loeb and I are equal partners in this. According to the schedule that I was to present the initial presentation in the defense, and that Jim Loeb will speak tomorrow at length. In the interest of parity, that has changed somewhat, that I will give the initial presentation that will be roughly the length of the prosecution, and Jim Loeb will follow up with some comments and will give a more lengthy presentation of the defense tomorrow. As a way of beginning and explaining the defense, let me offer some questions. Where are the internationalists on the left and the right who say that absolute deference to national sovereignty should be the basis for multilateral relations? Where are the internationalists who say that foreign and military policy should be guided by and realism rather than by a strong sense of moral clarity? Where are the internationalists who believe that traditional diplomacy is the only effective instrument for advancing and protecting international cooperation and peace? And where are the internationalists who believe that the United Nations can and will always act expeditiously and effectively to protect our mutual security and our common rights? If internationalists who hold such beliefs are among us, let them cast the first stones against PNAC. But in doing so, they should understand that PNAC is not alone in its conviction that U.S. military, economic, diplomatic, technological dominance requires Washington exercise global leadership. Neither does PNAC stand alone in its belief that global leadership should be guided by moral clarity, or in the belief that the U.S. government should use its superior military power to ensure world order and peace. These are convictions that are widely shared in the United States political community and by the U.S. public. Across the political spectrum in the 1990s, the end of the Cold War and the rapid pace of globalization combined to cast the history of U.S. foreign policy into a memory hole. But PNAC's charter signatories insisted that we not forget the lessons of history, the fundamental role played by the United States in leading the Allies to victory in two world wars, and by establishing the norms and institutions that finally brought political and economic order to the 20th century. As PNAC itself declared, the history of the 20th century should have taught us that it is important to shape circumstances before crises emerge and to meet threats before they become dire. The history of this century, meaning the 20th century, should have taught us to embrace the cause of American leadership. In the 1990s, while other political sectors in the United States floundering and unable to resolve the contradictions in their own principles and policies, PNAC boldly charted a new course for U.S. international engagement. And what was the counterpart agenda, international affairs agenda of progressives and liberals in the 1990s? Although instinctively and historically anti-interventionist, many progressives in the 1990s advocated interventionism around the world in Somalia and Bosnia, Haiti, Rwanda, and Kosovo. There were also some progressives who supported U.S. political intervention in the form of U.S. political aid to foster democratization in countries ranging from Cambodia to Mexico to the former Yugoslavia. For the most part, however, progressives ignored the conundrums and challenges of traditional foreign policy and security issues, concentrating instead on foreign economic policies. It would be not much of an exaggeration to say that in progressive circles before September 11th, economic globalization was treated as a synonym for international affairs. In other words, most progressives sidelined traditional issues of international relations, leaving those questions to strategists and ideologues of the right. Some criticize PNAC's foreign and military policy as being narrowly tied to U.S. economic interest. That is not a fair criticism, at least in light of PNAC's published analysis and policy recommendations. In its statement of principles, PNAC calls for a foreign and military policy driven by morals and values, not by profits. The statement complained that in the post-Cold War administrations, quote, the promise of short-term commercial benefits threatens to override strategic considerations. In public documents by PNAC and its associates, the moral fundaments guiding their foreign policy vision are those declared by America's founding fathers. and they make strong argument that, quote, the principles of the Declaration of Independence are not merely the choices of a particular culture, but are universal, end quote, or as the founders themselves asserted, quote, self-evident truths. In its moral moorings, PNAC's foreign policy agenda has far more in common with the international engagement principles advocated by the traditional left and progressives than it does with the tenets of the traditional rightist or foreign policy realist. Because of the principles on which it is based, the internationalism described by PNAC's ideologues is eminently more defensible than the foreign policy objectives of European governments that prioritize commercial interests. If Pax Americana envisioned by PNAC is regarded as an empire by its critics, then it is a new kind of empire, one driven at least as much by moral mission as by national economic interest. As the founders of PNAC said, William Kristol and Robert Kagan advised in 1996 in their foreign affairs essay, the United States should not blindly do business with every nation, no matter its regime. Voices within the Democratic Party from Europe and among press progressives in global networks around the world routinely charge PNAC's foreign policy agenda for a new world order represents a radical break with traditional frameworks. Indeed, that's one of the criticisms at this tribunal. But given the sad state of those traditional frameworks and the absence of other effective global leadership, shouldn't PNAC be established new frameworks? Should the tattered frameworks be retained, or is radical revisioning needed? Traditionally, U.S. hegemony has held close consultation association with Western Europe. But why should the world order of the 21st century remain a construct of 20th century Atlanticism? Neoconservative ideology holds that certain cherished political and religious rights should be universal. Furthermore, that until those rights take hold in the Middle East and North Africa, prosperity will remain at risk. A clean break is needed from the old frameworks in the Middle East. Who will argue that authoritarian regimes in the Middle East should not be restructured? The casualties in the terrorist attacks in New York City and Madrid were victims of traditionalism that mires the Middle East in fundamentalism, anti-intellectualism, and authoritarianism. Most frequently cited critiques of PNAC's ideological radicalism is the neoconservatives' failure to support post-Cold War framework of multilateralism. It should be recognized in PNAC's writings, its founders pay homage to the visionary leadership of the liberal internationalists post-World War II, the Democratic Party's statesmen who broke the back of republican isolationism of the 1940s and 1950s. In its efforts to craft a modern, more effective global order, PNAC cast aside the retrograde nationalism and militarism of the traditional right, and it dismissed the center left's knee-jerk defense of post-World War II multilateralism that was increasingly ineffective and gutless. Instead, PNAC called for a radically new internationalism, one that refused to bow to the sanctity of failed policy frameworks and that solidly criticized those who would retreat to isolationism or an economistic foreign policy. The PNAC team advanced a policy framework in which international affairs are restructured by coalitions of the willing, inspired by U.S. leadership and fortified U.S. might and resolve. No longer would rogue nations, obstructionist great powers like Russia or China, or outdated international rules that unduly revere national sovereignty stand in the way of groups of nations determined to protect themselves from national or subnational threats to peace. Some Western European governments condemn the neoconservative agenda and the Bush administration for advocating such a framework of international engagement, but their vision is clouded by their own naivete and hypocrisy. Western Europe and the United Nations stood idly by as the ethnic fratricide in the borders of its own of the former Yugoslavia. Only when the United States signaled its political will to intervene did Western Europe act to secure the peace and foster the political restructuring of the Balkans. Although Western Europe nations often condemn U.S. internationalists for their militarism and expansionism, they remain willing partners in the U.S.-led North Atlantic Military Alliance that perfunctorily acknowledges fears of Russia and other Eastern nations. Too much can be made of neoconservative radicalism. If there is a vice to be found in the neoconservative vision for a U.S. foreign and military policy, the dark thread runs deep in America. The genius of PNAC's agenda for the new American century lies less in its innovative features, such as its embrace of the politics of regime change and a preventive war against the threats to Pax Americana, than in a blending of core traditional components of Americana. If one is to condemn the neoconservative vision, then one must also denounce all historical tendencies that run deep in U.S. foreign policy. PNAC has produced a powerful blend of the best aspects of American nationalism, isolationism, messianism, exceptionalism, and realism. And in the dossier, I have a glossary of those terms that explains those integrated them. It has distilled the essence of American belief structures. In the process, PNAC helped bring together diverse constituencies behind a new ideology of American supremacy. I'd like to respond to the four questions raised by the Commission of the Brussels Tribunal. Question one, can PNAC documents be considered a founding element of the Bush foreign policy? It is clear that the policy documents prepared by PNAC associates form the blueprints for the national security doctrine of the George Bush administration. PNAC founders set out, quote, to lay the groundwork for a neo-Reaganite foreign policy, and they largely succeeded. This outcome testifies to their intellectual, strategic, and political abilities of PNAC associates, as well as and their grasp of enduring peace of the American public. And one footnote, that while indeed that is true, security strategy, as the document that we've been given, it's only in the strictly military part of that document where it is reflected. There are many other aspects of that document, indeed the major part of the document, that deal with such issues as free trade that do not reflect the PNAC blueprint. In fact, PNAC does not deal with issues of free trade. There is little doubt Washington's foreign policy is based on the ideology and policy vision of a small circle of neoconservative strategists and military complex advisors. However, any criticism that a cadre of visionaries unduly influenced the foreign policy apparatus of the U.S. government could also be leveled against many previous administration brain trust. Foreign policy in the United States, as elsewhere, is historically in the domain of competing elites from different sectors of the business, academic, think tank, and political community. What normative judgment, then, should follow from this conclusion about PNAC influence? In the median term, it is found that PNAC's vision did not enhance the security and expand the reach of universal values, then the burden of this shortcoming must fairly be shared by the competing political sectors, both in the United States and around the world, who all failed to take up the intellectual and political challenges of articulating a new foreign policy vision in the post-Cold War period. History will record that the neoconservatives took up this challenge for the world's hegemonic power, while other political actors shirked from the task. Question two, can the foreign and military policy operations of the Bush administration be considered the implementation of the principles and policy recommendations set forth by PNAC? Again, the answer is clearly yes. However, these policies, including support for the hardliners in Israel, the bombing campaign against the Taliban government, the invasion of Iraq, to the newly confrontational relations with the rogue states of Iran, Syria, and Korea, the new emphasis on the protection of religious rights of Christians and Jews around the world, and the expansion of NATO, have enjoyed broad bipartisan popular support in the United States and the world community. If such actions prove less than helpful or are deemed violation of international law, then the blame rests with the larger community that supported the policy and ideological frameworks outlined by this small clique of neoconservatives. Have the principles and proposals set forth by PNAC led to decreased international stability and security? There is no doubt that international affairs today are more conflictive than in the 1990s. But the implicit accusation that PNAC visionaries, and by extension, administration policies, are responsible for this instability is politically motivated, politically charged, and is not an objective assessment of the root causes of current instability and threats to peace. In 1997, PNAC's founders warned that a lack of attention to international affairs and a lack of serious consideration of the responsibilities incumbent on the world's only superpower constituted the primary threat to international peace and stability. It could well be argued that a lack of serious attention in the 1990s to the rise of Islamic militancy, the problems of entrenched Middle East, North Africa dictatorships, the buildup of weapons of mass destruction by Iran, Pakistan, North Korea, China's militarism and political repression, the ineffectiveness of the United Nations, and the failure to guarantee Israel's security have resulted in the instability we now experience. It's too early to evaluate the consequence of PNAC's agenda and the Bush Doctrine. Quoting a quote that often comes to mind in these circumstances of a Chinese premier who said, in evaluating the French Revolution, that it's too early. That was 200 years later to evaluate the consequences of the French Revolution. Only a year or so later, it's too early to evaluate the consequences of the PNAC agenda in terms of spreading peace, democratization, security in the world. In the medium term, we may very well come to the conclusion that these neoconservative initiatives spark much-needed political reforms in the Middle East, obligated rogue regimes to desist from attempts to acquire weapons of mass destruction, much as Libya had, and encouraged other powers to assume a more responsible role in meeting threats to peace and human rights around the world. Final question. Who are the figures and what are the special interests behind PNAC, and do they extend beyond those appropriate to a nonprofit educational organization in the United States? Although overwhelmingly Republican, PNAC associates include some Democrats, PNAC's founders profoundly believe in the conservative slogan, ideas have consequences. The success of PNAC in achieving bipartisan support for much of its agenda is a tribute to the power of the strategically focused educational institute. Clearly, many PNAC signatories later joined the Bush administration, but this by no means qualifies PNAC as an educational or nonprofit institution, nor does the interchange between government and foreign policy institutes constitute a new phenomenon in U.S. foreign policy. This question should be placed in a proper context. By way of comparison, it's worth considering the connections and influence of the Progressive Policy Institute, which recently published its own foreign policy blueprint. It's qualified as a nonprofit educational organization if its members are supported or invited to join a future Democratic administration. It's also relevant to note, with respect to the larger questions of PNAC's accountability, that the policy framework of the proposed progressive internationalism in many respects mirrors the neoconservative posture. Like PNAC's founders, the Progressive Policy Institute hails tough-minded internationalism and cites past Democratic presidents such as Harry Clinton. When one looks to the future of PNAC, as PNAC has, care should be taken in any attempt to attribute the structure of what the Brussels Tribunal calls the neo-imperial order solely to PNAC and neoconservatives. Consider, for example, the following statement. Quote, we aim to rebuild the moral foundations of U.S. global leadership by harnessing America's awesome power to universal values of liberal democracy. This is an expression that calls conservative internationalism or an articulation of progressive internationalism. And if one believes that such statements that link power, leadership, morality, and mission are trappings of Pax Americana, then the following questions must be discussed. What's wrong with seeking morality and moral foundations for U.S. leadership? Is it arrogant to assume the responsibility for global leadership, given many dimensions of U.S. power and given the absence of other sources of global leadership? Do critics of American leadership dispute the existence of universal values as expressed in the U.S. Declaration of Independence? And aren't universal values best promoted by liberal democracy? Finally, what are the alternatives to the benevolent hegemony of a Pax Americana? If the critique of PNAC is that its principles and policy recommendations haven't produced the benevolent hegemony its founders intended, what principles and what policies would ensure a benevolent U.S. global leadership? If one disputes the entire notion of Pax Americana, what are the real alternatives to the exercise of U.S. military power as a guarantor of international security? And ending, would the European Union, Russia, China, Japan, or the General Assembly or Security Council of the United Nations be willing to assume the burden of the, quote, muscular internationalism that the leading internationalists of both parties in the United States say is a fundamental condition to international security and stability? If the history of the 20th century, the first American century, is our guide, then it's unlikely that serious alternatives to Pax Americana will emerge in the near future. Thank you.